Eliza and the Stairs. Eliza Snow is arguably the most prominent woman in early Mormon history. Though Emma was Joseph's wife and helpmeet, Eliza Snow would go west with the saints. She was an advisor to Brigham Young, president of the Relief Society, and was influential in the formation of both the children's ministry, primary, and the youth ministry, now called Young Men and Young Women. Eliza was prominent in the campaign that won female suffrage in Utah in 1870, fully 50 years before all women in the rest of the United States would receive the right to vote. Besides all these accomplishments, Eliza Snow was regarded as a prophetess, and her hundreds of poems were treasured, whether they conveyed doctrine, as in the concept of a mother in heaven conveyed in the hymn, O My Father, or comforted those who had recently lost an infant. Eliza as Deceitful Seducer. In 1984, Doubleday published Mormon Enigma, a biography of Emma Smith written by Linda King Newell and Valene Tippetts Avery. In 1984, there was great excitement about a number of previously undiscovered documents from early Mormon history, including documents painting Joseph Smith as a being committed to a magical worldview, telling of a vision of a white salamander, and documenting Joseph's use of magic to dig for money. As Linda Newell and Valene Avery put together their view of Joseph's wife Emma, they used these new documents to inform their understanding of the man Emma loved. They found Joseph to be a flawed man who wedded and bedded women behind Emma's back. The betrayal Val Avery felt Joseph had practiced caused her so much distress that she could only write about Joseph and these women for a few minutes before she would literally feel the gorge rise within her. Val would vomit, then go lay down to regain her composure enough to write for a few more minutes. The women Newell and Avery believed Joseph had bedded were anathema. Of all Emma's friends, Newell and Avery said bedded Emma's husband, Eliza Snow was the worst. She was Emma's confidant in the Relief Society. Emma had taken Eliza into her own home. In return, the authors believed, Eliza had betrayed Emma by sleeping with Emma's husband under Emma's own roof. Newell and Avery's book won the Evans Biography Award, the Mormon History Association Best Book Award, and the John Whitmer Historical Association Best Book Award. But the mainstream Mormon community was shocked by the harsh betrayal of their founding prophet. Though Newell and Avery were not excommunicated, they were prohibited from discussing their research or book in church meetings. In late 1985, seemingly unrelated to Newell and Avery, a bomber targeted Stephen Christensen and Christensen's employer, J. Gary Sheets. Christensen and Kathy Sheets were killed. Investigators initially suspected the bombings were associated with a failing investment business Sheets and Christensen had been involved in. However, the bomber struck again the next day, this time severely injuring Mark Hoffman, a man who had been discovering numerous historical documents. As the investigation proceeded, Mark Hoffman was determined to be the bomber, and his documents were found to be forgeries. 10 years after publication of Mormon Enigma, Newell and Avery issued an updated edition. The 1994 edition removed the information that had come directly from the Hoffman forgeries. However, the underlying structure of the book, portraying a good woman betrayed by a craven husband and deceitful female friends, remained. No doubt the authors would object. Few scholars admit the extent to which underlying paradigms shape the soft science of interpreting the hard data. However, it is telling the number of women who have read Mormon Enigma and consider Eliza Snow to be a traitor, the archetype of Emma's female friends and associates who are presumed to have lain with Emma's husband. Eliza and the Stairs. One of the most evocative stories regarding Emma's alleged distress regarding polygamy involves Eliza. One late fourth-hand account relates, quote, "A door opposite opened, and dainty little dark-haired Eliza R. Snow, she was heavy with child, came out. Joseph then walked on to the stairway, where he tenderly kissed Eliza, and then came on downstairs towards Brother Rich. Just as he had reached the bottom step, there was a commotion on the stairway, and both Joseph and Brother Rich turned quickly to see Eliza come tumbling down the stairs. Emma had pushed her, in a fit of rage and jealousy. She stood at the top of the stairs, glowering, her countenance a picture of hell. Joseph quickly picked up the little lady, and with her in his arms he turned and looked up at Emma, who then burst into tears and ran to her room. Joseph carried the hurt and bruised Eliza up the stairs and to her room. "Her hip was injured, and that is why she always afterwards favored that leg," said Charles C. Rich. "She lost the unborn babe." Close quote. Anti-Mormon Wilhelm Weil recounted in 1886 a version of the same tale, where Emma feels, quote, "outraged as a wife and betrayed as a friend," close quote, and so takes a broom to Eliza in revenge. Eliza's nephew, Leroy Snow, said Emma knocked Eliza down the stairs, causing a miscarriage. Mary Barzee Boyce recounts a rumor from her son-in-law's mother, Ada Clement, saying Emma pulled Eliza R. Snow downstairs by the hair of her head. In a Utah where Eliza was respected and Emma had flouted leaders of the Utah Church, these stories painted Emma Smith as crazed and violent. But once Eliza was herself gone from living memory, a humanized Emma is seen as the victim, reacting in an understandable manner to finding her friend's unborn child is the get of Emma's husband, Joseph. While Mormon Enigma and an earlier article on this subject in BYU Studies cast doubt on the reliability of these staircase reports, nowhere is there an alternative to the fundamental betrayal Emma would have experienced if Eliza were sleeping with Joseph within a plural marriage of which Emma was uninformed and not consulted. Eliza as victim. As discussed in Wives of Sorrow, there is a strong pattern suggesting nearly all the women who became plural wives in 1842 had been victims of false teachings regarding spiritual wifery, the anything-goes-if-no-one-finds-out illicit intercourse Bennett and his strikers were urging women of Nauvoo to participate in. Eliza provided an affidavit in 1869 stating she had been sealed to Joseph Smith on June 29, 1842, placing her marriage to Joseph in the middle of the fallout related to John C. Bennett's departure from Nauvoo. Our regard for Eliza and her righteousness prevents most from easily accepting the possibility that Eliza could have fallen prey to Bennett. Ironically, no one seriously challenges the thought that this same honorable and righteous Eliza could have been secretly having sex with Joseph behind Emma's back, even if she didn't get pregnant and lose the child in a fall down the stairs. Let us consciously open our minds, however, to the possibility that Eliza, this wise, good woman, could have been seduced. I propose Bennett's purpose for seducing Eliza was not Eliza herself. We know Bennett had been courting a young woman, someone he had promised to marry. But after April 1841, it would have been impossible for Bennett to marry the woman he loved, since now Joseph Smith was informed of Bennett's wife Mary, who still lived and was still married to Bennett. I propose the young woman Bennett loved was Elvira Annie Coles, nearly a decade younger than Bennett, and an intimate of the Smith household where Bennett had initially lived in Nauvoo. By the time Bennett was ready to approach his beloved with a tale of spiritual wifery which might have won her to his bed, the Relief Society had been formed, and Elvira was ensconced in the heart of the new organization teaching women to hold to virtue no matter who the messenger. Bennett might easily have hesitated to approach Elvira without knowing if his line was plausible. Eliza served with Elvira and was also single. Eliza could therefore serve as a dress rehearsal, allowing Bennett to refine his tale one last time before approaching his beloved. I suggest Bennett took the raw line that had succeeded with Catherine Fuller and clothed it in portentous language, suggesting an eternal purpose. Bennett would go on to describe a Mormon seraglio with three levels of females. The initial order Bennett described were allegedly Cyprian saints, the women who sought out information regarding those who had lost their virtue. The women Bennett styled as Cyprian saints resemble those women who were acting as detectives on behalf of Joseph and Emma, seeking to uncover the full truth about Bennett and his seducers. The second order in Bennett's female sexual hierarchy were allegedly the chambered sisters of charity. Bennett wrote, "This order comprises that class of females who indulge their sensual propensities without restraint, whether married or single, by the express permission of the prophet. They are much more numerous than the Cyprian saints. This results naturally from the greater respectability of their order." The second group bears an astonishing resemblance to the many women, like Catherine Fuller, that Bennett and his strikers had seduced. The highest order in Bennett's female hierarchy, then, were consecrates of the cloister, or cloistered saints. This degree is composed of females, whether married or unmarried, who, by an express grant and gift of God, through his prophet the Holy Joe, are set apart and consecrated to the use and benefit of particular individuals as secret spiritual wives. When an apostle, high priest, elder, or scribe conceives an affection for a female, and he has satisfactorily ascertained that she experiences a mutual flame, he communicates confidentially to the prophet his affaire du cœur, and requests him to inquire of the Lord. Let us imagine that Bennett wished to practice this tale, that a woman could become a secret spiritual wife for the, quote, use and benefit, close quote, of a particular individual. How might Eliza react to being told Bennett wished her as a secret wife, and that Bennett had won the permission of Joseph Smith himself to partake of Eliza's affections, if only she, too, was willing to accept this gift of human companionship? Eliza's poems and journal. Eliza would write, "Dearest, the hour approaches our destinies to twine in one eternal wreath of fate as holy beings join. I would not sell thy confidence for all the pearls that strew the ocean's bed, or all the gems that sparkle in Peru." This poem appears to accept the proposal that someone, perhaps Eliza, become a secret bride. In the poem, the bride has not yet been bedded. It is not certain when Eliza wrote this poem, or when the woman in the poem agreed to be bedded. By mid-June 1842, Joseph Smith made a decision to publicly cut Bennett off from the church, reversing his earlier inclination to show Bennett mercy. Eliza describes her father's decision to leave Nauvoo as well the next day, though it would take Oliver Snow a week to arrange all his affairs in support of the departure. Eliza decided to remain in Nauvoo and moved into the home of Sarah Cleveland, one of Emma's Relief Society counselors. I propose that by this point she was already carrying Bennett's child, possibly conceived mere days before Bennett's exposure in the paper. On June 29, 1842, Eliza records the first entry in the journal she'd been given at the formation of the Relief Society on March 17, 1842. She writes, quote, "This is a day of much interest to my feelings. Reflecting on past occurrences, a variety of thoughts have presented themselves to my mind with regard to events which have chased each other in rapid succession in the scenery of human life. I am contemplating the present state of society, the powers of darkness, and the prejudices of the human mind which stand arrayed like an impregnable barrier against the work of God." Close quote. Eliza would later affirm that this was the day she became sealed to Joseph Smith, with Sarah Cleveland standing as witness. To me, this passage not only hides the fact of her sealing to Joseph Smith, it reads like the musings of a misled woman who was taken in sin and is reflecting on her confession of those sins. On August 12th, Elvira Coles visited Eliza, a social call that might not have been noted had it not immediately preceded disturbing events. On August 13th, Eliza's poem, The Bride's Avowal, was published in The Wasp, the newspaper William Smith edited. William had been accused of being complicit in Bennett's seductions and was almost certainly sympathetic to the exiled Dr. Bennett. Eliza's first-person language and talk of secret marriage could be read as confirming all that Bennett was alleging about Joseph Smith. Eliza writes Sarah Cleveland made it clear that her future plans would not be consistent with Eliza remaining in the Cleveland home. Quote, "Mrs. Cleveland, having come to the determination of moving on to her lot, my former expectations were frustrated." Close quote. I imagine Elvira Coles pleading with Emma Smith to take Eliza Snow into the arms of the Smith family. At any rate, Emma sent for Eliza Snow, her secretary, author of the damning poem in William's paper. Plausible deniability. If Eliza was pregnant by this point, the fashions of the day would continue to hide the fact for several months. Eliza could comfortably mingle in society for up to 5 months after the date of conception before there was a risk of being identified as pregnant. We know of at least one 1842 plural marriage that was arranged to care for a woman, Mary Clift, impregnated by one of Bennett's men, Gustavus Hills. If Eliza was pregnant, we should expect to see someone who steps forward to offer Eliza public marriage. The next poem in Eliza's diary may provide such evidence. On September 17, 1842, Eliza composed the following. Conjugal, to Jonathan and Elvira. Like two streams whose gentle forces mingling in one current blend, like two waves whose outward courses to the ocean's bosom tend, like two rays that kiss each other in the presence of the sun, like two drops that run together and forever are but one. May your mutual vows be plighted, may your hearts no longer twain, and your spirits be united in an everlasting chain. Jonathan had been a fixture in the Smith household ever since his wife, Marietta Carter Holmes, had been killed in August 1840. He had never remarried. Eliza's presence in the Smith home for the past month provided the surface possibility that the widower could have fallen in love with this formidable spinster. All this could have been part of the discussion Elvira Coles had with Eliza Snow on August 12th. I have not examined the original journal, but I propose Eliza may have altered her journal after November 15, 1842. Consider the poem again, as Eliza might originally have written it. Conjugal to Jonathan. Like two streams whose gentle forces mingling in one current blend, like two waves whose outward courses to the ocean's bosom tend, like two rays that kiss each other in the presence of the sun, like two drops that run together and forever are but one, may our mutual vows be plighted, may our hearts no longer twain, and our spirits be united in an everlasting chain. Whether Jonathan was to marry Eliza or Elvira, he had to get busy. The property he owned, just east of the Smith homestead, was almost certainly not a fit abode for a wife, as the cabin had been burned by the mob in August 1840. Jonathan had his bodyguard duties and his business as a cobbler to tend to. A possibly pregnant Eliza would not need to disappear from public view until the end of November. Time enough for Jonathan to rebuild a log home on the site of the one the mob had destroyed. Apostrophe to death, extracting Eliza's history from her poetry. The many stories about Eliza and the staircase were written by people who no longer lived in Nauvoo. They appeared to have forgotten that their stories were impossible for either the homestead or the mansion house, which was under construction in 1842. There is no central staircase in the mansion house like the one in the story. The staircase in the homestead is a small, enclosed stair. However, the scene works for the red brick store, with a broad, open staircase running from the back of the store up to Joseph's office. Allow me to spin some midrash. I imagine Eliza and Emma stopping in to visit Joseph's office, located in the upper floor of the red brick store. It is the middle of November. Almost time for Eliza to go into seclusion, if she is to maintain the appearance that the child she will bear could have been engendered by the man who will become her public spouse. Joseph gives Eliza a pastoral hug. Eliza and Emma turn to descend the stairs. Then Eliza trips. The staircase in the red brick store is too wide and open for her to break her fall the way she could have done in a narrow enclosed staircase. I imagine Charles C. Rich at the base of the stairs, looking up at the commotion, to see Eliza tumbling down towards him, Emma still at the top of the stairs, horrified by the fall Eliza is experiencing. Emma darts into Joseph's office to get his help. Joseph bounds down the stairs and gathers the battered Eliza in his arms. He carries Eliza gently to the empty mansion house. Emma meets him there, along with Patty Sessions. They work to ease Eliza's pains, but the damage is too great. The tiny, perfect baby miscarries. Eliza holds a small girl child in her hand and names the child Eliza after herself. Following November 15th, we find a series of four poems in Eliza Snow's journal. This portion of Eliza's journal contains no dates, so we only know these poems are written somewhere between 16 November and 30 November 1842. The first poem, which lacks regular meter and rhyme, is an address to death. The poem is shot through with imagery from the Book of Mormon and evokes John Donne's poem, Death Be Not Proud. My resident expert in English criticism suggests that Eliza is trying to convince herself in this poem. Quote, "What art thou, death? I've seen thy visage, and have heard thy sound, the deep, low murmuring sound that rises on thy tread. Thy land is called a land of shadows, and thy path a path of blind contingents, gloominess, and fear, thy form comprising all that's terrible. For all the terrors that have crossed the earth or crept into its lower depths have been associated with the thoughts of death. Seen as thou art, by inspiration's light, thou hast no look the righteous need to fear. With all thy ghastliness, amid the grief thy presence brings, I hear a thrilling tone of music, sweet as seraph notes that ride upon the balmy breath of summer eve. Art thou a tyrant, holding the black reins of destiny that binds the future course of man's existence? No. Thou art, O death, a haggard porter, charged to wait before the grave, life's portal to the worlds on high." Close quote. The second work is similarly free verse, without regular rhyme or rhythm, and gives Eliza's testimony. Scholars of Eliza's life will know this work, as it is one of the two Eliza used to conclude her autobiography in 1885, titled Sketch of My Life. Viewed through the lens of historicism, Eliza is clearly in a personal relationship with the man she refers to as a vile wretch. Eliza uses the term innocence to describe herself, and speaks of how the vile wretch fed himself, face to face, on the peace and blood of her innocence. This poem also shows Eliza as very alone and abandoned. Quote, "It is no trifling thing to be a saint, to stand unmoved beneath the withering rock of vile apostasy, when men depart from the pure principles of righteousness, those principles requiring man to live by every word proceeding from the mouth of God, to stand unwavering, undismayed, and unseduced, when the base hypocrite whose deeds take hold on hell, whose face is garbed with saintly looks, drawn out by sacrilege from a profession, but assumed and thrown around him for a mantle to enclose the black corruption of a putrid heart. To stand on virtue's lofty pinnacle, clad in the heavenly robes of innocence, amid that worse than every other blast, the blast that strikes at moral character, with floods of falsehood foaming with abuse, thrown side by side and face to face with that foul-hearted spirit, blacker than the soul of midnight's darkest jade, the traitor, the vile wretch that feeds his sordid selfishness upon the peace and blood of innocence, the faithless, rotten-hearted wretch whose tongue speaks words of trust and fond fidelity, while treachery, like a viper, coils behind the smile that dances in his evil eye. To be a saint requires a noble sacrifice. The grand consummation will repay the price, however costly. Then let me be a saint, and be prepared for the approaching day, which like a snare will soon surprise the hypocrite, and expose the rottenness of human schemes. In the third poem during these 3 weeks, I see an Eliza for whom past concerns, pregnancy, exposure, and marriage, are gone. But gone also is the sweet life of the one she carried, possibly a girl child named Eliza. In Eliza's convalescence, she is alone to rest and think about the lingering and eternal spirit of the individual who might have been entrusted to her to raise. This poem, alone of the four that make up this quartet, will never be published during Eliza Snow's lifetime. Quote, "Oh, how sweet is retirement! How precious these hours! They are dearer to me than midsummer's gay flowers. Their soft stillness and silence awaken the muse. 'Tis a time, 'tis a place, that the minstrel should choose while so sweetly the moments in silence pass by, when there's nobody here but Eliza and I." This is truly a moment particularly fraught with unbound meditation and freedom of thought, such rich hallowed seasons are wont to inspire with the breath of Parnassus, the languishing lyre, for sweet silence is dancing in solitude's eye, when there's nobody here but Eliza and I. O thou, favorite retirement, palladium of joys, removed from the bustle of nonsense and noise, where mind strengthens its empire, enlarges its sphere, while it soars like the eagle or roams like the deer of these still sober moments, how swiftly they fly, while there's nobody here but Eliza and I. In the final of Eliza's poems written in her November seclusion, Eliza embraces the forgiveness of Christ, the ability to return to, quote, conscious innocence, close quote. The noblest, proudest joys that this world's favor can dispense are far inferior to the bliss of conscious innocence. It makes the righteous soul rejoice with weight of ills oppressed, to feel the soothing, still small voice low whispering in the breast. And when in Christ the spirit finds that sweet, that promised rest, in spite of every power that binds, we feel that we are blessed. Though vile reproach its volume swell, and friends withdraw their love, if conscience whisper, all is well, and God and heaven approve, we'll triumph over every ill and hold our treasure fast, and stand at length on Zion's hill, secure from every blast. Denouement. With the possible November death of the child Eliza carried, there would no longer be a need for Jonathan to marry Eliza. But the cabin was built, and a marriage was expected. Elvira Annie Coles, Eliza's friend, and the woman who had cared for Jonathan's daughter since the death of Marietta Carter Holmes, would stand by Jonathan's side when Joseph performed the ceremony on December 1, 1842. Eliza's poem, as it now appeared in Eliza's journal, had indicated Jonathan and Elvira should be together. But as the marriage between Jonathan and Elvira would not seem to be consummated for several more years, the reason for the public wedding is not known. One clue might be a letter from Augustine Books to Joseph Smith, asking Smith to convey Augustine's regards to Elvira. Or, if Elvira had been Bennett's beloved, the marriage might have been intended to end Bennett's hopes of ever possessing Elvira. By 12 December, Joseph and Emma had persuaded Eliza to break her solitude. A school had been organized that would be held in the Masonic Hall, and the Smiths asked Eliza to be an instructor in the school. Eliza was initially skeptical, describing it as, quote, arduous business with my delicate constitution in this inclement season of the year, close quote. Eliza would teach the school every day until classes were released on March 17, 1843. This would begin a notable tradition of Eliza's concern for the youth in the gospel. On 11 February 1843, Eliza, quote, took board and had my lodgings removed to the residence of Brother J. Holmes, close quote. This date, so often given as the timing of the incident with the stairs, appears to have coincided with Joseph's activity of, quote, changing furniture in the house to receive Mother Smith and the family, close quote. Jonathan, Eliza, and Elvira, friends who had supported one another the previous summer, were reunited again for a period. By March, the last of the men and women directly impacted by Bennett and the strikers had been gathered in and counseled in secret. But thousands had been wounded by Bennett's accusations. Of particular concern were those women who had been questioned during the desperate investigation, the ones who didn't know the difference between spiritual wifery and the new and everlasting covenant. These young ones suspected they knew what was going on, and it appeared to them Joseph was everything Bennett had hinted.